The etude is an exercise. It's a way to develop a pianist's technique. The concept is as old as the keyboard, but by the early 19th century, as keyboards became bigger and more versatile, and keyboard performances moved from public to private venues, composers began writing etudes that were suitable for the concert hall. The greatest of them all was Franz Liszt with his Transcendental Etudes. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What sort of skills did Liszt test with his etudes? What were his models? And what makes his etudes transcend mere keyboard exercises? Joining us to celebrate the 200th anniversary of Liszt's birth, the actual day was yesterday, is pianist Christopher Taylor, professor of music at the UW-Madison, whose recordings include, among other things, all 12 of the Transcendental Etudes of Franz Liszt.
Well, welcome back to University of the Air.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You perform many different composers' works. I'm wondering, when you think of Liszt, what comes to your mind? He's such a colorful figure.
Indeed, indeed. He has a very sort of bifurcated personality, I think. There is the side of Liszt that's a little bit decadent, of course.
The early side, mostly.
Mostly, yeah. Flashy and, a little too enamored of his own incredible pianistic technique and showing off to the world. But he definitely mellowed with age, and there is a side of him that's extremely sophisticated and profound, and quite often his pieces seem to fall onto one side of the dividing line or the other. There are a few that sort of straddle it, but to my mind, his etudes and the Transcendental Etudes in particular are amazingly sophisticated, sublime even, and I don't think his writing got any more profound. And it's surprising that, this form that originated just with finger exercises became his vehicle for the most personal and moving self-expression.
The title, Transcendental Etudes, almost seems like an oxymoron. In other words, the etudes where you think of study, you think of something you're doing as a piano pupil to learn technique, and then you wouldn't think of that as necessarily being transcendental, something that would lift you above the mundane.
That's right. I think he intentionally had that sort of almost contradictory quality in the title. It's interesting that in German they're called, I forget, Etuden mit aufsteigender Schwierigkeit or something like that.
Climbing.
Which is, with rising difficulty or increasing difficulty, which sort of makes it sound like number one is pretty easy and get harder
right,
from
there. We'll get to that in a minute.
But that's, that doesn't describe it accurately either. So I'm not quite sure why the French and German titles don't seem to jive exactly.
The Liszt does have the reputation for tinkering with his works almost throughout his lifetime, more so than other composers. You find, various versions of early works throughout his career, whether it's piano or orchestra. Is that true of the Transcendental Etudes?
Indeed, indeed. It's a fascinating story with the Transcendental Etudes because there are three versions out there. The first version he wrote around the age of 12 or so, I believe it was. So they're very juvenile little composition exercises, and clearly influenced by his teacher, Carl Czerny. So they have that rather light quality to them. And yet there is the kernel of something great, even in these student exercises. And just, every now and then a beautiful melody.
Which I don't recall from the Czerny. My recollection of Czerny's like School of Velocity and some of those other exercises is pretty limited, but I don't remember a lot of tunes coming out of them.
That's right. That's right. So already at the age of 12, Liszt was beginning to move beyond what his teacher had pioneered.
Czerny must have been pretty astonished at the talent of his pupil.
Well, everyone was. I mean, he was incomparable prodigy, supposedly even Beethoven gave him his blessing.
Sure, the proverbial pat on the head of the child wunderkind.
Right, yeah. But he was a prodigy who made good for sure, which is, of course, there's no guarantee about that. Anyway, the second version of the Transcendental Etudes then he wrote in his 20s, and it is sort of the fullest flowering of Liszt's decadent technical self-indulgence. So, I mean, it's astounding density of notes. They definitely make the final version, the third version, which everyone plays, look, you know, very streamlined by comparison. But I think what Liszt came to realize is that, you know, when you throw more and more notes into a piece, you reach diminishing returns eventually.
That it actually dilutes some of the real essence of the piece.
That's right. And, I mean, of course, no one knows for sure, but it seems to me that some of the passages he wrote, it's just not possible to play them very fast. I mean, there are just so many notes that... And there's so many jumps that, I mean, you would have to move at sort of supersonic speeds to actually, you know, play Wilde Jagd, for instance,
the
eighth one, to play it at a sort of presto speed with his original version, with all of its 32nd notes and so forth. I don't believe it's physically possible. Now, maybe Liszt really was a magician beyond our comprehending. But I think he came to realize that he had passed the point of diminishing returns and that it was time to cull out some of the excess. And the results, you know, sound much more brilliant and much more impressive, even though, I mean, they're easier in some sense.
Would they have been possible even to play on a piano, say, 20 years earlier, just in terms of the instruments available?
Basically not, I would say. The range of the piano was gradually increasing. So certainly there were plenty of notes that would have been off the ends of the keyboard 20 years earlier. And, the construction of the instrument was getting steadily more sturdy, and they were starting to introduce iron plates in there for reinforcing. And
I would just imagine them going out of tune in the middle of some of these etudes.
Oh, yeah, and strings breaking all over the place. And certainly Beethoven was famous for breaking his pianos. Of course, I guess to some extent that's because he was trying to play loudly enough that he could hear.
Right, pounding on it. What about the relationship of the 12 etudes to each other? Does it form some kind of pattern?
They do, I think, form a logical kind of progression. Just in terms of the keys they're written in, first of all. I suppose this was inspired in part by the model of the well-tempered clavier of Bach, where, you know, he systematically explored every key. Similarly here. Although here the keys sort of... In Bach, you know, you have C major, C minor, C sharp major, C sharp minor, and so on, going on up. And so when you move, for instance, from C minor to C sharp major, that's quite a radical disconnect. Here, the progression of keys is a little smoother. So you go from C major to A minor, and then to F major and to D minor. And those keys are all share characteristics, and one flows into the next very smoothly. And this alternation of major and minor is definitely, I think, a feature that, you know, even a pretty naive audience member can sort of make sense of.
Oh, yeah, I get that. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And 10 of the 12 have titles that Liszt gave them.
That's right. And that was something that came in the third version of the etudes. So initially they had no titles, and then in a flight of mid-romantic fancy, I guess, he decided on descriptive titles, which are very apt. It's kind of hard to imagine that the etudes ever existed without their titles.
Except for the first one and the second one. And the first one he just calls prelude. And you have already said, Kit, that contrary to some expectations, this is not the easiest of the 12. Far from it.
No. Well, it at least has the benefit that it's short, so your suffering is over quickly.
And, let's see what that first one sounds like and then find out what all is packed into 55 seconds of this prelude, the first of the Transcendental Etudes by Liszt. To hear it without smiling.
It's definitely Liszt asserting himself right from the outset and establishing who's boss, you know, and sort of making the pianist show his credentials at the door right away.
So with the second etude being Molto Vivace, does it go even faster than that?
It does. It goes somewhat faster, and it's actually harder, the second etude. It's funny that it doesn't have a title because it's a very vivid etude, that second one. But I guess the poetic fancy didn't strike him or whatever.
And as long as we're there, let's hear that one too.
Makes my hands hurt just listening to that.
That's a wonderful one. It's and of course it is very difficult with lots of leaps and fast finger work and a tremendous variety of techniques in a very short amount of time, and that's something that definitely distinguishes these etudes from the Chopin etudes, where he takes a basic technical idea, a basic premise, and follows it in a fairly consistent way throughout the whole etude. This one, it's all over the map. So one moment it's octaves, the next moment it's scales and arpeggios. But incredibly effective pianistic writing. And although it's hard, it's, you know, it's gratifying. It works well on the piano, and you get a lot of bang for your practicing.
Literally.
And, you know, for instance, his favorite trick of alternating hands of, you know, just in very rapid succession, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, you know, you can create a lot of sound and a lot of excitement, and it's not even really that insanely difficult once you manage to program your brain to pass between the two hemispheres back and forth consistently.
Would he have played these transcendental etudes in concert? And if so, would he have played all 12, do you think?
I'm not certain about – I mean, I'm certain he performed them. And whether he sat down and did the cycle – I'm not sure about that. I mean, 19th century programming practices usually weren't like that. You kind of jumped around a lot more. And
so we don't know, or do we know, what the popular, what the audience reaction to these pieces was. We know he was a phenomenally popular superstar, celebrity pianist. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I can't help thinking of these, the first times he would have played them in public would have been, what, maybe in the 1830s?
And, with the second version, yes.
And so we're talking about, oh, you know, not more than about 10 years after Beethoven, for example. Did people think that Liszt was a little bit crazy when they heard some of these?
Well, I think so. And I think the cognoscenti probably looked down their noses at him as, you know, just a showman and a little tacky, not as sophisticated as the Beethovens and the Schuberts, of course. But, of course, the general public obviously was swept away by the incredible spectacle. And, of course, Paganini had kind of...
The great violinist was really set the pattern for the superstar, didn't he?
That's right.
On the notes of your CD, it mentions that Liszt coined the term recital for what he was doing, and this whole idea of the, you know, fixing the piano so the profile of the pianist would be seen, and with women tossing things and so on. When you're performing Liszt, do you ever sort of feel a sense of Liszt the showman, Liszt the charismatic, virtuoso, rock star type performer? Do you ever feel that presence?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It's quite fun, I must say. But as I said, I mean, there's the other side to Liszt, and as he matured, that side became more and more evident, and there was less of this of the blatantly cheesy stuff.
We're going to look more at the Transcendental Etudes of Franz Liszt when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Passage, that's the third of the 12 Transcendental Etudes of Franz Liszt, as played by our guest today, Christopher Taylor. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and we have already sampled what might be called the more vivacious side of Liszt's personality in these 12 Transcendental Etudes. There, for contrast, we gave you a look at a landscape which almost comes across at times as the romantic Liszt, the lover.
Certainly, yeah, very, very much so. And Liszt, the melodist, for sure, and beautiful soaring tune, and all sorts of interesting things going on in there, rhythmically, and I mean, all beneath this very tranquil and unassuming exterior, there's some sophisticated rhythmic games going on, and certainly interesting harmonies always, and very rich and rewarding pianistic writing, and so definitely enjoyable to play, and also a good respite from the craziness.
Good break. How would you be able to tell that that's Liszt and not Chopin, for example? What is it that makes the sort of unique Liszt sound even in the slower etude?
Huh. Yeah, interesting question. I was mentioning sort of the rhythmic quirks, and the different ways, the different textures that he has underlying the melodies are a little different from Chopin. I mean, usually in Chopin there's a nice sort of smooth flow going on underneath. So, for instance, the left-hand parts in the nocturnes are usually quite consistent, you know, some sort of, you know, oompa-pa kind of pattern or something
more rhythmical
like that.
Than melodic in the left hand.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And usually flowing along in a very consistent sort of way. Here, I mean, it is a steady flow of eighth notes. So in that regard, it's kind of Chopin-like in this paysage etude. But it has these little quirks, accentuations in weird places, and bass notes falling in places other than the downbeat, things like that. So that sort of suggests just a different texture and a different sound world.
Now, one of these 12, only one so far as I know, Liszt orchestrated.
Right, right. You're referring to Mazeppa. Yeah, that's... Mazeppa is possibly one of the more decadent ones, and probably the ones that, you know, the intelligentsia look down their noses at.
You say decadent, how so?
Self-indulgent?
Just in terms of the show-off quality?
Yeah, that's right. Now, I happen to love Mazeppa, and I think it's, you know, the best of that sort of showmanship. But, for instance, one thing that it features a lot of that the other etudes don't have too much of is diminished seventh harmonies. Now, these are the harmonies that you always hear, like in the old silent movies, whenever the villain came in, they would always play a diminished seventh chord. And it's a harmony that sort of has become cheapened over the years. And
you do associate some of Liszt with silent films, don't you?
That's right.
And what does the title Mazeppa mean?
Well, it's the name of a Hungarian revolutionary who is involved in resistance against against the Russians. And anyway, they eventually caught him, and his punishment was that he was strapped naked to a horse and had to go.
And the horse was driven wild.
Driven wild, and off he went. But apparently he survived. And
becomes a kind of a chieftain himself,
yes,
if I remember the story correctly.
Right, right.
It's based on like Victor Hugo or something.
That's right, that's right. And I mean, ultimately it's based on some sort of historical reality, but of course it's become tremendously doctored up by Liszt and his like. And
you do get a good sense, though, in Liszt's piece of the lopsidedness of this out-of-control ride across the steps.
That's right. That's right. And, I mean, this very unusual piano technique he has. Another example of these interesting textures that Liszt pioneered. So you're playing the melody in big chords in both hands. I mean... It's harmonized in both hands. And then in between these big chords that are carrying the tune, you have these accompanying figures in thirds that are sort of the left hand does a couple, then the right hand does a couple, and then the left hand does a couple, and then back out to the chords, and then a couple of lefts, a couple of rights, a couple of lefts. So the sort of back and forth, and the hands continually going from the outer parts of the keyboard in towards the center and back and forth, back and forth.
Yeah. Kind of a gymnastic feat.
Oh, yes. But it does, yeah, I mean, it creates this sort of frenetic quality. And, yeah, something a little lopsided about it, as you said, this wild, barely controlled ride.
Well, let's ride for just a moment with Mazeppa.
Good. And so the opening, then, you'll hear these diminished seventh chords. And in some lists, you know, they're horribly overused. But in this, I think he manages to keep them in check. And they're very effective and dramatic, as you'll hear.
Too much to be convinced this is a wild ride across uneven ground.
Indeed.
But he added the title later, you said.
That's
which is
right.
Kind of hard to then
right.
figure where the title came, whether he sort of had something of the sort in mind back when he was young and starting it or just sort of heard it later as that way.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. It's kind of hilarious, actually, to look at the very first version of this that he wrote when he was 12, because it's basically it is this idea of the hands alternating, but there's not the melody, so it's just just back and forth, three notes in each hand, and just kind of going up and down. First in a D minor chord, then on an A major chord, and back and forth. So incredibly simple-minded. And yet from that little kernel of an idea of just the hands each taking a couple of notes, he created this incredible accompanying figure. And, somewhere along the line, I guess it transformed itself into something that suggests sort of crazy horsemanship, and then that must have been when his Victor Hugo popped into his mind.
Do you see his Hungarian roots coming in terms of the sound? I mean, obviously due to the subject matter of Mazeppa, but are there other ways that you can tell this is someone born in Hungary?
Well, he was a very cosmopolitan guy, and he never spoke any Hungarian. And he grew up speaking German and then French he used for most of his life. So I think his connection with the Hungarian peasantry was kind of a theoretical thing in some ways. But he was definitely interested in
And he wrote those Hungarian rhapsodies, of course.
Hungarian rhapsodies, yeah. And he was fascinated with Hungarian tunes, or the idea of Hungarian tunes, and some of the more exotic Hungarian scales and so forth that, you know, you can't necessarily capture on a piano keyboard because, you know, we only have 12 notes per octave. But you know, there are ways to approximate these exotic Hungarian harmonies and scales. And so he did do some of that, and it may even show up, for instance, in just in Mazeppa after the diminished seventh chords at the beginning. Then there are these scales that sort of feature scales like the harmonic minor that have a little bit of sort of kind of orientalism in them, a little exoticism, and so that shows up in there and gives it its special piquant flavor.
When you're performing the 12, is there one that is sort of the dreaded one, the one that is the hardest?
Huh. Well, it's I guess it's kind of like mountaineering in the Himalayas, you know. They each have their own little challenges. In Fufale number 5,
the Will-O-the-Wisp
is very devilish, and some really nasty twisting of the third, fourth, and fifth fingers, the weaker fingers of the right hand. So that one causes a certain amount of fear. Wilde Jagd, the Wild Hunt, number 8, has some tremendous leaps in it that, you know, to some extent you have to just, you know, say a quick prayer and see what happens, whether you land in the right spot. Of course, that's not quite true, but he obviously was quite a jumper list, and he imposed those on us. So those are some highlights of the terrifying moments. But in general, it's pure pleasure to play them. They're so gratifying on so many different levels, from the purely sort of physical enjoyment of speeding around the keyboard to the philosophical enjoyment of master compositional craftsmanship.
Well, let's hear some of the Will-O-the-Wisp and get some insight into those finger-twisting aspects of the Transcendental Etudes of Liszt. Anyway, didn't they? But this is certainly one of the more demanding ones.
Yes, indeed.
We're going to listen to the Evening Harmonies and Snow Squalls of Franz Liszt when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I sat near Liszt so that I could see both his hands and face. For the first time in my life, I beheld real inspiration. For the first time, I heard the true tones of the piano. He played one of his own compositions. There was nothing strange or excessive about his manner. His manipulation of the instrument was quiet and easy, and his face was simply grand, the lips compressed and the head thrown a little backward. When the music expressed quiet rapture or devotion, a sweet smile flitted over his features. When it was triumphant, the nostrils dilated. There was nothing petty or egoistic to mar the picture. That's 19th century novelist George Eliot describing Franz Liszt, who turned 200 years old yesterday. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Christopher Taylor, who has recorded all 12 of the Transcendental Etudes, the work that we're focusing on right now. Well, do you think Liszt sometimes suffers from this reputation as a showman and that we can forget maybe the more melodic, deeper side?
Oh, definitely. One can easily overlook the profundity of his thinking in amongst all of the fireworks.
I was just thinking when George Eliot says that there was nothing egoistic, that sort of almost is in contrast to music that seems desired to show off, look what I can do with my hands on this keyboard, and other people can't do anything like that. There is a sort of egotism to Liszt, is there not?
Yeah. I mean, those words came as a bit of a surprise, I suppose. But I think, it's hard to parse exactly what she meant, but I suppose the point is just, you know, when you're in the presence of, you know, real artistic greatness, you know, you do forget about the mortal who's actually producing it and who may have, you know, his own vanities and his own agenda, his own desire to show off to the ladies or whatever. We forget about all of that. And you know, probably to some extent, I mean, to a great extent, I'm sure he did too. I mean, I've had that experience too. On many occasions when performing, I mean, you forget about, you know, here I am trying to impress people or whatever, and you just get involved in the magic of the art form.
And he did donate a lot of the proceeds from his performances to charity, right?
Yeah. I mean, he was definitely a decent human being. And towards the end, I mean, perhaps approach of his mortality and worries about whether he'd get into heaven and his his libertine past, he entered the orders and became the Abbé Liszt, and his music also lost all of its showmanship completely and became quite abstract and
introspective.
Yeah, and quite avant-garde in some ways.
There's one piece, I can't remember exactly what it's called. It's kind of a generic title, but it's essentially like something to the effect of prelude in no key in particular.
Right. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I can't remember.
And it does sound avant-garde even today.
Yeah. It was definitely experimentalist to the end. I mean, he was no longer experimenting so much with the most flashy effects, impressive effects you can get on the piano.
The seventh of the Transcendental Etudes is an E-flat, and he calls it Eroica. Is he referring in the music to Beethoven?
It's a little hard to make that out. I mean, it certainly would seem with that title and the key being the same as the Beethoven Symphony that there must be some reference going on there. But it's an odd form of heroism in the Eroica. It's sort of tongue-in-cheek almost. It's a kind of stuttering, hesitant sort of heroism that's not really what you find in the Beethoven Third Symphony. Sort of there are these virtuosic outbursts, but then they're sort of interrupted and there's a pause and he hesitates and then he does this kind of stuttering little march.
The anti-hero. Is Liszt have a sense of humor then?
Well, I think sometimes, yeah, a little whimsy there. Thank you.
Well, there is some indecision there, isn't there? At least on the part of whoever is doing the speaking in that eroica of Liszt's Transcendental Etudes.
What about the Evening Harmonies Etude?
That's a really wonderful, rich, sort of pure chocolate kind of sound in it, and very evocative of evening bells and so forth. And this was one actually that he particularly reworked. I mean, it seems like it's basically a totally different piece than what it was in the earlier versions, and something, far mellower than he could have produced as a 12-year-old or even as a 25-year-old. It's a foreshadowing of the older Liszt, the wise old sage of the piano.
Does it tie in with the key? In other words, this one being in D-flat major, is there some link between the quality of a key and the title and mood that he gives to it?
I certainly feel that particular keys have particular associations. And, I mean, maybe that's partly because, we've heard pieces like Harmonie du Soir, and so we come to associate D-flat major with this sort of incredibly rich, mellow, soothing and yet at the same time very grand quality. And of course, there are lots and lots. Even though it's slow, there's a high density of notes. I mean, there's your fingers are certainly doing plenty of stuff, but it sounds very peaceful and not at all frenetic, quite the opposite of what you have in so many of these etudes.
And Evening Harmonies and La Ricordanza, which is also a reflective piece, those are far and away the biggest pieces, the longest pieces of the Transcendental Etudes.
Yeah, I guess that's right. Yeah.
So you do get a good, generous dose of that later, more reflective Liszt, even in these earlier pieces.
Yes, that's right. You can certainly tell where he was headed.
Let's hear a bit of the Evening Harmonies.
Thank you.
seems to love the trills, doesn't he? In places, at least. I mean, he's very generous with the embellishments.
Yeah, that's right. And, I mean, of course, that one, a big feature is the arpeggiated chords, the brum, 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 brum. In fact, I mean, there's so many of them that it's a danger of it becoming a little ridiculous.
Self-parody. Yeah.
Harpo Marx on steroids or something.
But it's very beautiful.
Of course.
Very lush.
To interpret it, though, you have to, you have to think very carefully about those and how not to let them become caricatures and to vary them in subtle ways and make them really interesting and unexpected.
With the 12th etude being Snow Squalls, was there any attempt with this to have it, kind of correspond to the 12 months and have it end with the 12th one being snow?
Huh, I never thought of that. I'm just trying to think if it's kind of summery in the middle.
Maybe that's pushing it. I'm just seeing that we end in snow.
It's an interesting idea, though.
The thing that Tchaikovsky would do later with the months.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. What's interesting about this cycle is, I mentioned that he goes through the keys in a very regular way, but he only gets through half of them. I mean, there are 24 different keys, and he only gets through 12. And I guess he had considered at some point finishing the cycle out, but he never got around to it. So,
and he ends in a minor key, and he ends with snow. Not exactly the most positive way to end, is it?
No. But it's, it is a very tragic and almost frightening, despairing kind of etude, this Chasse-Neige. I think it's probably my favorite. It's so evocative and just sublimely beautiful. Just a simple tune that he came up with as a 12-year-old, and he saw the potential in it by dressing it up in this incredible pianistic clothing. He could take it from a pretty tune that's a little trivial into the realm of just earth-shaking and extremely significant and moving music.
Chasse-Neige, the Snow Squall, the last of the Transcendental Etudes of Liszt. The snow squall, La Chasse-Neige, that ends the 12 Transcendental Etudes of Franz Liszt, the pianist. Christopher Taylor has been our guest this hour. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. I love discussing these pieces and hearing them again.
And thanks for your artistry as a performer.
We'll look forward to your next visit. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.